This is Frank Gregorski welcoming you to another audio artifact commemorating Republicans in the United States House of Representatives. On July 24, 1974, the House Judiciary Committee is beginning the public climax of its impeachment proceedings against President Richard Nixon. Over the following 6 days, 3 articles of impeachment will be voted out and 2 others voted down. And this MP3 file, 79 minutes total, showcases 7 of the 17 Republicans who are on that committee, including the 4 who are in their first term. Speaking for the rank-and-file Republicans across the country who appear willing to swallow large amounts of policy and ethical betrayals by Nixon and his people, you'll hear Delbert Latta, elected in 1958. From Virginia, M. Caldwell Butler eloquently counters with, "We nominated this man. His people have committed an array of crimes. This is our Republican Party, and we had dang well better clean it up." These 7 statements, along with remarks by the other 31 Judiciary Committee members, are being made on national television July 24th and 25th. And here is the order for the rest of this particular file. Robert McClory of Illinois starts off, then Latta of Ohio, Charles Sadman of New Jersey, who is probably Nixon's most colorful defender, and then the 4 freshmen, Butler of Virginia, already mentioned, and Harold Frelick of Wisconsin, Bill Cohen of Maine, and Trent Lott of Mississippi. Robert McClory's service in the House will run from 1963 through 1980. Here he is on the evening of Wednesday, July 24th, 1974.
Impeachment is, of course, a political process, both political in the sense of governmental action and political in that it involves partisan interests and views. It would be the grossest understatement on my part to suggest that Watergate and all that that word implies has not caused serious injury to my party, the Republican Party. And this is so despite the fact that no element of our established Republican Party organization was involved, and no Republican member of the Congress has in any way been implicated in this whole affair. Let me assert, on the contrary, that Republicans, even more than Democrats, are anxious to erase this blemish from our party. I've heard it said by some that they cannot understand how a Republican could vote to impeach a Republican president. Let me hasten to assert that that argument demeans my role here. It would infer that no matter what high crimes and misdemeanors might have been committed, that if attributable to a Republican president, then I, as a Republican, am foreclosed from judging the merits of the case. I cannot and do not envision my role in that dim light. As a purely partisan matter, would it enhance our Republican Party if, despite the evidence and the weight of constitutional law, we as Republicans on this side of the aisle decide to exonerate a Republican president accused of high crimes and misdemeanors simply because he and we are Republicans? I see that line as leading to Republican Party disaster. A viable two-party system, to my mind, is an institution worthy of preserving, second only to our constitutional system of checks and balances. Preserving our Republican Party does not, to my mind, imply that we must preserve and justify a man in office who would deliberately and arbitrarily defy the legal processes of the Congress, nor can our party be enhanced if we, as Republican members of the United States House of Representatives, tolerate the flouting of our laws by a president who is constitutionally charged with seeing that the laws are faithfully executed as provided in Article 2. We will enhance our Republican Party and assure a viable two-party system only if we are courageous enough and wise enough to reject such conduct, even if attributed to a Republican president. The essential question which we must answer is not what is best for our party, but what is best for our nation. While the investigation has been far-reaching and has, in my opinion, delved into some peripheral areas, I cannot help but recognize that on the major subjects which have been investigated, the work of the committee and of our committee staff has been both objective and bipartisan. I would like particularly to observe that we've been assisted by able counsel and to make a general observation that the members of the minority staff, the Republican staff, have contributed substantially to the overall work product of our inquiry. Despite our partisan differences, I would add that you, Mr. Chairman, have, in general, been very fair with the minority. The American public need have no fear that the Republican interests have not been ably and appropriately served by our ranking member, Mr. Ed Hutchinson of Michigan, and by my other distinguished and able colleagues who sit on the Republican side in this committee room. I shall turn at once to the main subject of our inquiry, namely the numerous allegations of wrongdoing charged against the President of the United States, all of which allegations we have investigated over a period of many months for the purpose of ascertaining whether or not President Nixon should be charged with the commission of an impeachable offense. The most serious allegations, and those upon which the President's accusers have placed principal reliance, go under the general title of Watergate and cover-up. Our majority counsel, Mr. Dorr, in interpreting the information before us, has expounded the thesis that the President organized and managed the Watergate cover-up from the time of the break-in on June 17, 1972, up until the present time. While serious questions exist regarding the President's authorization or acquiescence in an obstruction of justice, a conclusion which might be reached from examining the transcripts of taped conversations and other evidence, the thesis advanced by Mr. Dorr that the President was in charge of a cover-up from the time of the break-in is, in my opinion, unjustified in the light of the evidence presented to our committee. Our chief minority counsel, the able Mr. Sam Garrison, made an important and extremely significant point in his final summation of the Watergate evidence. He said, "Mr. Dorr's case of circumstances showing presidential involvement from the beginning is a very, very weak one. Because you cannot simply aggregate suspicions, you cannot aggregate inferences upon inferences, you can only aggregate facts." Watergate is a serious matter. Many in and out of the White House have been involved in this tragic episode. But while voluminous evidence has been produced, I question seriously that it is of the clear and convincing nature that should impel us to indict the President on a charge of cover-up or obstruction of justice. Instead, the case against the President rests upon circumstantial evidence, inferences, innuendos, and a generous measure of wishful thinking on the part of some who would indict the President even without adequate proof of wrongdoing in the Watergate affair. Now, in the light of today's Supreme Court decision, there may be indeed other available evidence to the committee within the next few days or weeks. Substantial additional evidence from the White House tapes upon which this committee can better judge the guilt or innocence of the President in the whole Watergate affair. The doctrine of absolute executive privilege upon which the President and his counsel relied has been substantially rejected by the Supreme Court. And we can expect, hopefully, that we will get promptly and without equivocation from the White House the additional tapes which we also subpoenaed and which are now under the President's decision to be made available to the special prosecutor. And we also have the mechanism for excising those irrelevant parts which might not be appropriate for us to see. Although on the basis of evidence thus far received, the case involving Watergate has been less than convincing, there are other subjects in which the facts are virtually undisputed, and where the only unsettled question is whether or not an impeachable offense has been committed under the Constitution, to which I made reference. If the extremely serious subject of Watergate results nevertheless in a weak case against the direct involvement of the President, this should not be construed to mean that there has been no wrongdoing in the White House. Watergate and the alleged cover-up involves the offense of obstruction of justice, for instance, payments of hush money, inducing witnesses to commit perjury, and others. These offenses have been committed at the White House or by the President's most intimate aides and friends. But if the President is not personally and criminally liable because the evidence does not directly and personally implicate him, nevertheless, we may appropriately ask, has the President fulfilled his obligation to see to a faithful execution of the laws, a solemn obligation imposed by the Constitution. This obligation is above and beyond that of other citizens, all of whom are required to obey the laws. We may ask further, is the office of the presidency being operated in the manner contemplated by the Constitution when, under the guise of national security, dissatisfaction with the head of the FBI, or personal animosity against enemies, we experience burglaries, wiretaps, bugging, unlawfully provided, shredding and concealment of evidence, misuse of the CIA, FBI, IRS, and a host of other misdeeds? It should not be hard for my solid Midwest constituents, Republicans, Democrats, and independents alike, to see and understand what's troubling me. Believe me, it's also troubling them. The question remains whether these acts and omissions of Richard Nixon as president are to be approved or denounced. If in these respects the president is to be denounced, and if the president is to be called to account for such acts and omissions, impeachment is the appropriate and constitutionally designated vehicle for bringing these specific charges against him. What about the offenses committed by Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Colson, LaRue, Dean, and others? There is substantial authority for attributing their misconduct to the president in a strictly legal sense and require him to account for their offenses. But there is the higher constitutional obligation to see that such criminal acts are not committed or condoned, a constitutional demand to see that the laws are obeyed, particularly in the president's own house, which we call the White House. After receiving evidence for weeks and weeks, evidence which has been frequently peripheral as it relates to direct involvement of the president in Watergate and other crimes, I ask myself, is this any way to run a White House or a country? Finally, the clearest and most convincing issue before us, and one which is perhaps more fundamental to our inquiry, is that of the committee's subpoenas, in which we requested information from the president. Fundamental to the entire impeachment inquiry is his obligation to provide us with the information which we require so that we can perform our role. We do want a strong chief executive, but we also want a Congress which is given full recognition, as well as the courts. Likewise, it's essential that the president respect that part of the Constitution which vests in the House the sole power of impeachment. The House Judiciary Committee, as the designated unit of the House of Representatives, is endeavoring to fulfill that role with honor and dignity consistent with our responsibilities. In this particular time in our history, we demand a Congress capable of exercising not only its lawmaking authority, but also its power of the oversight function, which includes that of the extraordinary authority of impeachment. Earlier this year, the president promised full cooperation with our inquiry, consistent with his responsibilities to the office of the presidency. But despite that pledge, the only materials which we've received have come from the grand jury and from the special prosecutor, except some that have accidentally fallen into our hands. On May 30, we sent the president a letter advising him what the consequences were of his failure to comply. We said, in meeting our constitutional responsibility, the committee members will be free to consider whether your refusals in and of themselves might constitute a ground for impeachment. The committee has taken this stand because of the president's noncompliance with the committee's subpoenas, a defiance of the powers of the Congress, and impairing our ability to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. In this sense, it seems to me the president's failure to comply threatens the integrity of our impeachment process itself. His action is a direct challenge to the Congress in the exercise of its solemn constitutional duty. These, then, are the issues which are disturbing me as we approach this final phase of our assignment under the House resolution authorizing this comprehensive impeachment inquiry, which my colleagues and I have been conducting, and which we must resolve deliberately and responsibly within the next few days. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Our founding fathers, in their wisdom, gave us a nation, a national government, of three separate and co-equal branches, each branch unbeholden to the other, but each with a different and a particular function to perform. This system has worked well throughout the years. It must work in the future. America has had weak and strong presidents, weak and strong Congresses, weak and strong Supreme Courts, all judged according to the likes and dislikes of those doing the judging. Notwithstanding the obvious strength of a particular branch and the comparative weakness of another at any given time, the doctrine of co-equal branches has survived to serve its function and serve it well. During all this time, the House has seen fit to impeach but one president. The president, the Senate, refused to remove that one. The unanswered question being, if the Senate had removed Andrew Johnson, would we still be enjoying the benefits derived only through the proper functioning of co-equal branches of government? Or would the legislative branch now be supreme and the president occupying not a co-equal but a lesser role in our government? No one can answer this question, and no one can foresee the consequences of a president's impeachment and removal by a Congress controlled by an opposition party. Would this mean that future Congresses with heavy political majorities would be more apt to initiate or threaten to initiate impeachment proceedings against the president of a different political faith just to make certain that he adhered to their wishes? Wouldn't the mere thought of impeachment by an opposition Congress cause future presidents to tailor their acts to the wishes of the Congress, thereby weakening the office of the presidency? All must agree that today's world demands strength, not weakness, in the office of the President of the United States. As we deliberate in the closing days of these hearings, each of us on this committee must consider the effect a president's removal would have on the strength of this office and the respect it enjoys throughout the world. I am not unmindful of the fact that President Nixon's ratings in the national polls are about as low as they possibly could be, that the present occupant of the White House is not in favor of the news media, that President Nixon has no chance of gaining a congressional majority in 1974, that many Republican office holders are saying aloud that they would fare better in the 1974 and 1976 elections with Vice President Ford in the White House, and that they believe the politically expedient thing to do would be to vote for impeachment. Yes, the cries of impeach, impeach, impeach are getting louder. That for these reasons alone, one could easily be led to believe that the proper thing to do would to vote to recommend impeachment. For the past year, allegation after allegation has been hurled at the president. Some of them have been stated so often, many people have come to accept them as facts without need of proof. Our job as members of this committee has been to sift through these allegations and to attempt to ascertain whether any or all of them are true and supportable on the floor of the House. Yes, and if need be, in the Senate of the United States. As members of this committee, we are aware that I, as a member, came here only last February by direction of our Committee on Committees. The Committee on Committees apparently believed that my liberal friends on the other side might possibly be persuaded to at least take a second look at some preconceived positions on this important matter. I'm here to tell my friends, and I put that in quotes, on the Committee on Committees, that they gave me an impossible assignment. How can the members of this committee, who have made public statements and have themselves introduced articles of impeachment prior to our deliberations, retract those statements, undo those actions, and assume a role as an impartial juror? How do you overcome the powerful influences of such pro-impeachment forces as organized labor, COPE, ADA, and similar groups on the minds of members sympathetic to their causes? The truthful answer is you don't. And I'm not about to represent to the good people of the 5th Congressional District of Ohio or the people of this great nation that you can do otherwise. Everybody on this committee detests wrongdoing. No one condones it. By my very nature, such things have always been repugnant to me, and I would be the first in line to punish any wrongdoer, the President of the United States included, once he is found guilty. I have said before, and I say now, show me the hard evidence that the President of the United States is guilty of the many serious charges being leveled against him, and I'll show you a vote for impeachment. This evidence must be clear and convincing. It cannot be based on inferences. We cannot make articles of impeachment lie against the President of the United States by attempting to infer that he had knowledge of wrongdoing that was going on in his administration. Yes, lo and behold, in the committee to reelect the president, which was composed of Democrats, Republicans, and independents alike, neither can we try to make him responsible under the old theory of principle of agent, as some of these articles are proposing. To impeach, there must be direct presidential involvement, and the evidence thus far has failed to produce it. This makes it imperative that this committee not rush to judgment at this hour without the benefit of knowing what is in the 64 tapes that the special prosecutor is to receive under this week's Supreme Court decision. I, for one, believe very deeply in one of the cherished and precious cornerstones of American justice, and that is that a person in America is considered innocent until proven guilty. Every American citizen, including the president, is entitled to this presumption of innocence. And contrary to what I've heard said, it is not incumbent upon the president to prove his innocence. It is incumbent upon this committee, if it goes to the floor of the House, to prove that he's guilty to the satisfaction of the members, and yes, on over to the Senate, if that arises. It was unfortunate during our deliberations that the American people were denied the right to listen to even the few witnesses who appeared before this committee by a party line vote, and are now only being invited to sit in on these hearings. They should have been permitted to listen to the tapes, expletives deleted, of course, in order they could draw their own conclusions from the total conversations rather than from bits and pieces extracted here and there to serve a particular purpose. Hopefully, before this matter is finally resolved, this opportunity will be given to them. Before considering the charges being leveled against the president by his chief accuser, John Dean, we perhaps should check briefly into his credibility as a witness in several instances. Make no mistake about it, John Dean came up with the answers to questions propounded by the Senate Watergate Committee from a good memory, and even bragged about it in several instances. When he appeared behind closed doors before this committee, knowing that we had listened to the tapes and had the transcripts before us, his testimony reveals that his memory was not as good as it was in the Senate, and he even apologized to us for not having a tape recorder memory. When Mr. Dean appeared before the Senate Watergate Committee, he stated his March 21st conversation with the president relative to paying attorney fees and family support was left hanging. In appearing before a closed session of this committee, he indicated he might have discussed the matter with the president at an earlier date. But by so doing, his testimony immediately came into conflict with a testimony in the Senate that his friend Mr. Moore, an attorney at the White House, had chastised him on the 20th for not going in and telling the president all the things he had been telling him. When Hunt's lawyer, Mr. O'Brien, appeared before our committee, he disagreed with Dean's testimony in several respects. As a matter of fact, under questioning by this member, he disagreed with Dean's testimony on three different places on 1.5 pages of the transcript. John Dean admitted before our committee that he became involved in the Watergate cover-up almost from the beginning. He also testified before our committee that he did not see the president after the June 17th break-in until September 15, and the president never gave him any instructions to cover up anything. He also testified before this committee that he authorized Caulfield to offer clemency to Watergate defendants, assisted Magruder in making a false statement, and initiated an unsuccessful IRS investigation of certain individuals prior to his September 15 meeting with the president. Quite frankly, these hearings gave me more information on President's chief accuser than I had previously had. Certainly during this committee's deliberations, one of the more important questions to be resolved is whether to choose to believe John Dean or the President of the United States. 8 of the 9 witnesses before the committee testified they had not discussed acts of wrongdoing with the president. Here again, John Dean stands alone. In conclusion, let me say if the committee decides to recommend impeachment of the president based on the wrongdoing of others, the evidence is here, and it's clear and convincing. If the committee decides to recommend impeachment based on direct evidence of presidential involvement in wrongdoing, the evidence is not here. The case is that simple.
I now recognize the gentleman from New Jersey, Mr. Sandman, for purposes of debate only for a period not to exceed 15 minutes. Mr. Sandman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not going to attempt to cover all of the charges that have been made. I'm going to isolate my statements to the major charge of the Watergate and Watergate cover-up. If it were not for that, I don't think we'd be here tonight. I think it's altogether proper, too, to commence by making a little bit of a review on what we've done, where we are tonight, and where we hope to go from here. My mind is unchanged as a result of the Supreme Court decision today. I believe that this committee should go on with its work. There are sufficient votes here for an impeachment resolution. This everyone knows. In fact, there has been that many votes here for a long time. There's no use kidding anybody about that. So regardless of what is in the new tapes, a majority does exist here to impeach the president for some reason or another. Now, I think that to say that this is the most unusual proceeding that I have ever been a part of would be a tremendous understatement. The thing that amuses me is that as important as it is, and even though it's been held in confidence behind closed doors, what I read in the papers from day to day lead me to believe I couldn't have been here. I must have been somewhere else. We started in closed session, and we swore by everything that was holy that we would uphold the rules of confidentiality. That has been the joke of the century. There has been nothing confidential in this committee. Members of the other side have reported to the media every hour on the hour, some every hour on the half hour. We have become the first forum in the history of man to release to the public every shred of information we have before a single decision was ever made. When did that ever happen before? Never. But we've done it. And then when we think about releasing information, I'm wondering. We have released tens of thousands of pages to the public and to the media. To the media to destroy if they choose, and some people in the media like to do that. And this involves hundreds of innocent people. Where was the American Civil Liberties Union about that? Isn't it strange that they have been remarkably silent? But willy-nilly, we have been willing, through one method or another, to give to the media, whatever method they want to use it, every shred of evidence that exists. And most of it is not evidence. The interesting thing about this, too, is what happened the other day, just for example. One thing that apparently the media hadn't had yet was a large document that had 715 pages in it about miscellaneous documents. I was asked, and so were the other members of this committee asked, Vote for this willy-nilly without the discussion of a single page or a single document. That's hardly the way you conduct a good hearing, is it? But that's the way we've been working. Fortunately, that was defeated. And now, another thing that happened the other day, I raised a question which I thought was a good one. I wanted to know whether or not counsel could advise me as to whether or not the articles of impeachment should be specific. Should each article involve a singular subject? I thought it should. Counsel never opened their mouth. We never got that far. And the chairman hit the gavel and under the table that went. So there's never been a decision even on that point. And from the law, as I understand the law, the articles that we've been handed tonight don't fit what the law requires, because here you have a general article of impeachment, everything including the kitchen sink. And this, they say, from the best information available to me, from some of the best legal minds in the world, should not be. I wanted to know, but I got no answer. Now, I have consistently said from time to time that the chairman has done a good job, a fair job, and I think he has. I complimented the staff, I complimented counsel, both majority and minority, but there's never been really much difference between those two. And I meant what I said then as I mean it tonight. But things started to change 3 weeks ago. 3 weeks ago, it changed from a nonpartisan inquiry into a highly partisan prosecution, if ever there was one. Now, let's see what happened. Better than that, I suppose I should do away with current events and get down to why we're here tonight. And I hope that this has some advantage. I really do. I don't know as we're going to change any votes. I hope we do, one way or another. I hope it serves a purpose. I can be persuaded if somebody, for the first time in 7 months, gives me something that is direct, I'll vote to impeach, and maybe that should be the challenge to my 36 other colleagues tonight, 37 others. Now, I want to say this at the very outset. This is not a case, as far as I'm concerned, for or against Richard Nixon. I ran for governor in my state last year, and Richard Nixon didn't help me one blessed bit. So I have no reason to feel kindly toward him. Now, secondly, this is the third time in my life that I have had to vote on whether or not someone should hold a very high office. And I think because of the coincidence, it's worth telling you a little bit about it. The first vote that I cast in my life as a public official was when I was the youngest member, newly elected, of the New Jersey State Senate. The first vote had to do with the seating of a Democrat senator. And if there's anything I think I know, it's the New Jersey election law. I listened to all of the experts from around the country testify, and at that time you only needed 11 Republicans to sign a petition, and that Democrat would never sit in the Senate. And we had 16, including me. I was the only Republican who voted to seat that Democrat. As a result of a long investigation, it proved I was the only Republican right. He was seated. 16 years to the day later, I cast my first vote in the Congress. And that was on the seating of Adam Clayton Powell. What a coincidence. It meant no difference to me whether his name was Powell, Nixon, or what it was. I voted my conscience as I understood the law without the persuasion of the Washington Post and others. I voted as I understood the law. I was one of only 13 Republicans, and I did not want Adam seated. But under the Constitution, as I understand it, the Congress did not have the right to exclude him for the reason they set forth. I was one of only 13 Republicans who voted to seat Adam Clayton Powell, purely on a constitutional grounds. Only one of 13. I may be one of less than that tonight. Who knows? And more than that, who cares? I'm doing this the way I think it should be done. This is the way I believe I pledged my oath of office. And although there were only 13 Republicans who voted to seat Adam, the United States Supreme Court said that only 13 Republicans were correct because they reversed the Congress and seated Adam. Now, for the first time in my life, I have to judge a Republican, the man who holds the most powerful office in the world, and make no mistake about that. Many wrongs have been committed, no question about it. But were those wrongs directed by the president? Is there direct evidence that said he had anything to do about it? Of course there isn't. And what has happened in the interim? Fair articles like this. Reliable News magazine, I'm told. What does it say? And if this isn't trying to incite the people into a frenzy against good judgment, you tell me what is. Newsweek, July 22nd, 1974. The evidence, only half of it, an extremely damaging sentence. It says, quoting the president, "I want you all to stonewall it. Let them plead the Fifth Amendment, cover it up, do anything, save the plan." Terrible, isn't it? They left off the other half of the president, as did that very fair Washington Post, when they buried on page 20 the other half of the sentence, which quoted the president as saying, "But I'd rather it be done the other way." This is what has happened every day, every hour on the hour. So we don't have to do this in frenzy. Let's do it the right way. The first tape of March 21, 1973 worried me to death. When I went to bed that night, I made up my mind the president is cooked. He doesn't have a chance. But the following morning, I heard another tape that was made only 3 hours later on the same day. And that completely did away with what was happening in the first tape. So you can't use one tape as this fair magazine has done. You can't use one part of a tape as the Washington Post did. You have to use it all in context to arrive at the truth. And this is what I suggest we do. Now, it is not the purpose of any media to make the news. It is the purpose and the objective of the media to fairly report the news. Now, to say, as this committee did over many weeks, everything that Haldeman knew, Nixon knew, that's not proof. And I want to pose this one last thing. I wonder what the prosecutor in the United States Senate is going to do for witnesses. I wonder what he's going to do. Is he going to plead his whole case on tapes because he can't use any of the witnesses we had? Because every one of them testified no act of wrongdoing on the part of the president. And if you don't think so, go through the lot. Who was the man who handled the money? LaRue. Was there any involvement by the president? His answer to the question, no. To the man who received the money, Bittner, the attorney. Did your client make any threat to get clemency from the president or any of his agents? The answer, no. As to the man who supposedly directed the payment of the money, Mitchell, did the president have anything to do with that direction? The answer, no. Now, with these kind of witnesses, how do you prove that case before the Senate? Is there a soul here who honestly believes that 67 out of 100 senators are willing to accept this kind of evidence? I don't think so. And I think this is why we're here. Now, maybe in the time that is remaining, someone, somehow, will point out the fact that I'm only human and I'm not infallible. Maybe I overlooked something. Maybe there is a tie-in with the president. All right, there's 37 of you. Give me that information. Give it to 202 million Americans. Because up to this moment, you haven't. Thank you.
I recognize the gentleman from Virginia, Mr. Butler, for purposes of general debate, not to exceed 15 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me express first, Mr. Chairman, and to you and the other members of the committee, the high regard I have come to have for all. While this has been a most distasteful experience for us all, I share great pride in the manner in which the membership of this committee, with few exceptions, has conducted itself in these deliberations. I want to express my personal appreciation for the staff for the monumental task which they have performed with such diligence over these months. Likewise, I would also like to express once more the pride that I share in the significant accomplishments of the administration of Richard Nixon. I have worked with him in every national campaign in which he has taken part. And indeed, there are those who suggest that I would not be here today were it not for our joint effort in 1972. And I am deeply grateful for the many kindnesses and courtesies he has shown me over the years. I am not unmindful of the loyalty I owe him. And I mention this, Mr. Chairman, so that you may be aware how distasteful this proceeding is for me, as it must have been for every other member of this committee. And one more thing. I have a word for my colleagues on this side of the aisle, and to my Republican friends who may be listening, and for my colleague from Indiana who is concerned about the effect impeachment will have on the Republican Party. For years, we Republicans have campaigned against corruption and misconduct in the administration of the government of the United States by the other party. Indeed, in my first political experience in 1952, Trumanism was the vehicle that carried Dwight Eisenhower to the White House. And somehow or other, we have found the circumstances to bring that issue before the American people in every succeeding national campaign. But Watergate is our shame. Those things happened in the Republican administration while we had a Republican in the White House, and every single person convicted to date has one way or the other owed allegiance to the Republican Party. We cannot indulge ourselves the luxury of patronizing or excusing the misconduct of our own people. These things have happened in our house, and it is our responsibility to do what we can to clear it up. It is we, not the Democrats, who must demonstrate that we are capable of enforcing the high standards we would set for them. I agree with the sentiments often expressed today and yesterday, that the Congress of the United States and each member is indeed being tested at this moment. But the American people may also reasonably inquire of the Republican Party, do you really mean what you have said? My colleague, the gentleman from California, Mr. Wiggins, in his very able opening remarks of this morning, reminds us once more that we must measure the conduct of the President of the United States against the standards imposed by law, in which he is eminently correct. I would like to share with you for a moment some observations I have with reference to these standards. Impeachment and trial in the Senate is the process by which we determine whether or not the President of the United States has measured up to the standards of conduct which the American people are reasonably entitled to expect of him. The conduct which the American people are reasonably entitled to expect of the President of the United States is spelled out in part in our Constitution and in part in our statutes. And we are particularly grateful to our colleague from New York, Congressman Fish, for his exposition on the duties imposed upon the President of the United States by our Constitution. It is my judgment also that the standard of conduct which the American people are reasonably entitled to expect of their president is established in part by experience and precedent. And this is one reason why I am so concerned by what has been revealed to us by our investigation. It will be remembered that only a few hours ago, the gentleman from Iowa, Mr. Maine, has argued that we should not impeach because of comparable misconduct in previous administrations. There are frightening implications for the future of our country if we do not impeach the President of the United States. Because we will, by this proceeding, establish as a matter of record a standard of conduct for the President of the United States, which will be for all time a matter of public record. If we fail to impeach, we have condoned and left unpunished a course of conduct totally inconsistent with the reasonable expectations of the American people. We will have condoned and left unpunished a presidential course of conduct designed to interfere with and obstruct the very process which he has sworn to uphold. And we will have condoned and left unpunished an abuse of power totally without justification. And we will have said to the American people, these misdeeds are inconsequential and unimportant. So if at the conclusion of the remarks I have some time remaining, Mr. Chairman, I will endeavor to respond to at least some of the earlier commentary on the evidence. But for the moment, I have two observations which must have a bearing on what this Congress shall eventually do. The people of the United States are entitled to assume that their president is telling the truth. The pattern of misrepresentation and half-truths that emerges from our investigation reveals a presidential policy cynically based on the premise that the truth itself is negotiable. Consider the case of Richard Kleindienst, nominee for the Attorney General of the United States,
The president had told him in unmistakable terms that he was not to appeal the AT&T case. But before the Senate of the United States, Mr. Kleindienst explicitly denied any effort by the president to influence him in this regard. And the president, having knowledge of this, affirmed to the people of the United States his continuing confidence in this man. The record is replete with official presidential misrepresentations of non-involvement and representations of investigations and reports never made, if indeed undertaken at all. There are two references to a Dean report, which we have not seen. Consider the case of Daniel Shore. In a moment of euphoria on Air Force One, presidential aide called upon the FBI to investigate this administration critic. Upon revelation, presidential aides fabricated and the president affirmed that Shore was being investigated for possible federal appointment. Nothing could be further from the truth. Let me also observe that throughout the extensive transcripts made available to us of intimate presidential conversation and discussion, there is no real evidence of regret for what has occurred or remorse or resolution to change, and precious little reference to or concern for constitutional responsibility or reflection upon the basic obligations of the office of the president. In short, a power appears to have corrupted. It is a sad chapter in American history, but I cannot condone what I have heard, I cannot excuse it, and I cannot and will not stand still for it. Now, this is not to suggest that there are not many areas of our investigation which clearly reveal to me that some charges do not elevate themselves to the status of an impeachable offense. I am satisfied that the presidential misrepresentations with reference to the Cambodian War is excusable because of congressional and Security Council involvement in the decision-making itself. The impoundment of funds by the Office of President is clearly an exercise of administrative discretion, which is now sharply curtailed by the Congress itself. While the manipulation of the decision to raise milk price supports by the president's advisors in order to reaffirm the pledge of substantial contributions is reprehensible and bordering on bribery in itself, the evidence as to the president's direct involvement has nowhere been established to the extent, in my judgment, to warrant a charge of impeachment. While I am seriously concerned about the manipulations of the deed of gift to vice presidential papers, I have real reservations as to whether the degree of presidential involvement makes him guilty of an impeachable tax fraud. But I do want to associate myself with the remarks of the gentleman from Illinois, Mr. Railsback, and others, and particularly the careful manner in which he has reviewed the president's response to the information which came to him in his official capacity, and his participation in the continuing policy of cover-up, at least after the 21st of March, 1973. This is clearly a policy of obstruction of justice which cannot go unnoticed. Likewise, I am concerned about the pattern of presidential abuse of the power given him by statute and by the Constitution. The manipulation of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Central Intelligence Agency, the Internal Revenue Service, and indeed the existence of the White House plumbers are frightening in their implications for the future of America. The misuse of power is the very essence of tyranny. But the evidence is clear and direct and convincing to me that the presidents of the United States condoned and encouraged the use of the Internal Revenue Service taxpayer audit as a means of harassing the president's political enemies. And consider, if you will, the frightening implications of that for a free society. Mr. Chairman, while I reserve my final judgment, I would be less than candid if I did not now say that my present inclination is to support articles incorporating my view as to the charges of obstruction of justice and abuse of power. But there will be no joy in it for me.
I recognize the gentleman from Wisconsin, Mr. Frelick, for the purposes of general debate for a period not to exceed 15 minutes. Mr. Frelick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, fellow Americans. We are today traveling an unknown path, a path that may lead to the impeachment, conviction, and removal from office of a president of the United States for the first time in 198 years. The obvious uncertainty that surrounds such an event frightens many Americans. The historical penalty levied against the man removed arouses great sympathy in others. This course of action now set, regardless of the final outcome, will have a profound effect on our system of government. As several other members have noted, these proceedings are more than a legal process. They represent a political process which includes partisan considerations. As a Republican loyal to his party, I have been eager to assure that these proceedings be fair. In this regard, I have sharply criticized actions or intended actions by the majority of this committee that seemed unduly partisan to me. I have worked to make these proceedings public so that the deplorable series of leaks would not be necessary and distortions of evidence could be avoided. I have worked for a full slate of witnesses so that the committee could ask firsthand about the involvement, and I supported down the line the active participation of the President's counsel, so that there would be every opportunity to rebut incriminating evidence and establish the President's innocence. Looking back over the whole proceeding, there is no question that partisanship has played a role. The fact that the inquiry has been as even-handed as it has is due to a considerable degree to the insistence by the Republican members. As a concerned American, as a privileged American in public service, I join a Republican president, Rutherford B. Hayes, who declared, "He serves his party best, who serves the country best." I make my decision on conscience, with no regard to political gain or loss, or partisan advantage or disadvantage. A decision under the Constitution and laws of this great nation as I am able to understand and interpret them. Those of us making the initial decisions here today certainly feel the burden of our task. We are indeed living with history. I have been told by some constituents that Mr. Nixon is without morals and that on that basis alone he should be impeached. Let me assure you that I am discouraged by the moral tone that shines through tape after tape and transcript after transcript, but that is not an impeachable offense. Mr. Hungate told us in one of his Missouri parables that because Mr. Nixon's net worth tripled while he was in the White House, he should be impeached. Should Mr. Johnson have been impeached because his net worth increased from $50,000 to $33.3 million while he was president of the United States, while he was in public service for over his lifetime? I think not. I think that is not a basis for impeachment. What is an impeachable offense? Are all crimes an impeachable offense? I think not. Are all impeachable offenses crimes? I think not. It is, to my mind, inconceivable for the Congress to impeach a president for anything less than grave offenses. And in most instances, these offenses will contain an element of criminality, when the evidence of misconduct must be very strong. The mandate that a president receives from the American people should not be overturned except for the most extraordinary and compelling considerations. I agree with both Mr. Doar and Mr. St. Clair that the charges must be proved in clear and convincing terms. Now, this million-dollar staff here before our committee has searched into every nook and cranny of this administration. They have found every sensational occurrence, every off-color remark, every mistake, every use of authority, every statement ever made to test it for vulnerability for impeachment. I wonder, ladies and gentlemen, how many past administrations could pass that scrutiny? This staff, without the direction and control of this full committee, came up with various areas of concern, which were briefed and presented to the full committee. The areas concerned Cambodia, impoundment, tax fraud, ITT, dairy fund contributions, San Clemente, Key Biscayne, and other personal finances. And one by one, again without any formal action of this committee, after the charge, after the leaks, after pages and pages and pages of press, after words and words and more words of media coverage, these charges slowly and slowly faded into the background. Now the articles of impeachment have been placed before the committee by the majority spokesman, Mr. Donahue. And these articles do not include the above-named charges. The charges that survive in the offered articles of impeachment allege in general terms obstruction of justice and abuse of power. One of the more specific charges of abuse of power includes noncompliance with committee subpoenas. This is a case of the alleged absolute power of the president versus the alleged absolute power of the Congress regarding its subpoenas. The president claims constitutional and historic traditional executive privilege doctrine, and the Congress claims exclusive power of impeachment. What reasonable man would not properly place this impasse before the third branch of government, the courts, for final arbitration and decision, both in the interest of either obtaining the information or substantiating the president's compliance or noncompliance under the Constitution? Well, this committee so refused, and therefore I must refuse to support this as an article of impeachment. An argument is frequently made that even if there is evidence of misconduct on the part of the president, it amounts to nothing worse than action of previous presidents. This is an argument that appeals to many people who are anxious to affirm their support of the president. I am convinced that some of our previous presidents have engaged in shabby, deplorable, and possibly illegal activities. I say this only after I read some documents I obtained yesterday from the Senate Watergate Committee, in which I have turned over to the minority counsel. But past misconduct cannot logically justify more of the same. A Congress interested in preserving and protecting the rights of our people must recognize and condemn misconduct in office wherever it occurs. And so I am brought to the evidence that troubles me. I shall not discuss it here in all its detail, but I must confess that I am deeply pained and troubled by some of the things I see. I am concerned about obstruction of justice, a cover-up plan that began on June 17, 1972, or soon thereafter, and continued to April 30, 1973, a plan alleged to involve the participation and knowledge of the president, a plan whose purpose was to save an administration from embarrassment, from losing votes in the November 1972 election, and ended up trying to save the longtime loyal aides from being charged with violation of criminal laws. I am concerned about the flurry of activity that took place in California, Washington, and Key Biscayne on June 17th, 18th, 19th, and 20th between Mitchell, Mardian, Magruder, LaRue, Ehrlichman, Colson, Haldeman, Dean, and Sloan, and the relationship of what these key staffers were doing to what the president could be reasonably expected to do and to know. The president, shown to be a man concerned with detail, a man concerned with the salad at the banquet table, a man concerned with the pictures on the wall at the banquet, a man who knew that Howard Hunt had possible connections with the White House, yet a man we are asked to believe did not demand or receive a clear and true picture of the real situation by June 30th, 1972. A man who talks on June 30th about the risk of something coming out and about cutting the loss fast. Yes, I am concerned about the references on March 21st when the president told Dean, "You have the right plan. Let me say, I have no doubts about the right plan before the election. You handle it just right. You contained it. Now after the election, we've got to have another plan." And well, the president told Mitchell on March 22nd, the whole theory has been containment. Yes, I am concerned about a March 20th, 1973 order to Dean to make a complete statement, but make it very incomplete. I am concerned about an order to Ehrlichman on April 16th, 1973 to create a scenario with regard to the president's role. I am concerned about the president telling Dean on March 21st, 1973, "Just be damn sure you say, I don't remember, I can't recall, I can't give an honest answer, an answer to that I can recall, but that's it." Yes, I am concerned about the way the president passed on to Haldeman and Ehrlichman, and through them to Colson, the information furnished to the President by Henry Peterson from April 16th to April 30th, 1973. After reassuring Peterson on April 16th that, of course, as you know, anything you tell me, as I think I told you earlier, will not be passed on. Yes, I am concerned about the missing tapes, the undelivered tapes, the gaps in the tapes. I am concerned about impeaching my president for his actions. My decision awaits final wording of the articles and the remaining debate. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
There are two major allegations with which I am concerned, which have been articulated much more eloquently than I can today, by Mr. Railsback, Mr. Flowers, Mr. Mann, Mr. Butler, and these involve the area of obstructing of justice and the use and abuse of governmental agencies to harass and intimidate private citizens for expressing their political preferences and views. But I would like to digress just for a moment, because you have heard and you will continue to hear a great deal about the evidence, that it's circumstantial in many instances and not direct. Well, first let me say that conspiracies are not born in the sunlight of direct observation. They are hatched in dark recesses, amid whispers and code words and verbal signals. Many times the footprints of guilt must be traced with the searchlight of probability, of common experience. And secondly, I want to point out that circumstantial evidence is just as valid evidence in the life of the law and that of logic as is direct evidence. In fact, sometimes I think it's much stronger. And the best example that I can give you is the fact that there are 38 members on this committee. They're all well-trained, skilled, competent people who sat here day after day listening to tapes, listening to witnesses, and yet they walked out of these doors into the arms of the press. And you had 38 different versions of what expletive the president used when he talked to Dean on March 21, 1973, when he said, "Get it." So you can see that even direct evidence has its imperfections. But on the other hand, let me give you an example of a strong circumstantial evidence that if you went to sleep at night and the ground was bare outside and you woke up with fresh snow on the ground, then certainly you would conclude as a reasonable person that snow had fallen even if you hadn't seen it. So let us not labor under the misapprehension that because some of the evidence available to us is circumstantial, it is therefore inadequate. I'd also like to address myself to some of the remarks made last evening and even this morning. My good friend from New Jersey, Mr. Sandman, correctly held up for you a news magazine which quoted only half of the statement. I happen to think the other half of the statement was equally as bad, but aside from that, I think the point he was making is quite accurate, and that is that a text torn out of context is a pretext, and I support that principle. I think he's absolutely correct. But I would ask the members of this committee, notwithstanding the fact that we're under the limit and constraints of time, not to engage in the same sort of conduct, not to pick and choose quotes and passages which will support a particular position. When we talk about whether or not the CIA was being used for improper purposes, let's examine what the president did know as of that time. Consider prior to the time that he ever contacted the CIA or had the CIA contacted in his behalf that on June 20, 1972, just a few days after the break-in, he had a phone conversation with Mr. Mitchell, his former attorney general. And by a dicta belt, his own dictation that evening, he indicated that Mr. Mitchell said that he apologized. He was deeply sorry that he failed to keep better control of his employees at CRP. So as of June 20, we know that there's a responsibility accepted and known by employees of the committee to reelect the president. Also consider that on June 20, 1972, a very long conversation between Mr. Haldeman and the president, during which Watergate was discussed, during which an 18-and-a-half-minute conversation has been rubbed out by some inexplicable and perhaps even sinister force. These factors must be taken into account when we consider what motive, what object the president may have had in mind in contacting the CIA. And let me take it one step further on this particular point. I heard the September 15, 1972 transcript quoted from today, and it was indicated, and again, I'm not ascribing any malevolent motive or evil intent here because we are under very strict time controls, But the impression was given that all the president said on September 15 was, yeah, yeah, and yeah. But I look at page 10, and I read from what the president said, I want the most comprehensive notes on all of those that have tried to do us in because they didn't have to do it. And Dean says that's right. They didn't have to do it. The president says that, in essence, things are going to change, and they're going to get it, right? And Mr. Dean says that's an exciting prospect. So I hope that in the future hours of debate that remain, as we come to this final decision, that we will not quote out of context, because Mr. Sandman is quite correct. We must consider the totality of circumstances, all of the evidence, all of the tapes, all of the implications, and all that they imply. I don't have time to go through and review all of the articles and the allegations that will be of importance to me. I indicated I share the concern of the area of abuse of power, particularly, as well as the cover-up aspect. But the aspect involving the IRS is a particular concern to me, because the American people are unquestionably the most generous in the world in sharing the fruits of their labor. We work hard, we pay taxes, and perhaps not always enthusiastically, but certainly with the hope and the belief that our tax dollars will be used for legitimate purposes and programs. The most serious and dangerous threat to our very society and liberties occurs when those in positions of power undertake to turn neutral instruments of government into agents of vengeance and retribution against private citizens who engage in the exercise of their constitutionally protected freedoms. If we're to have confidence in the concept of even-handed treatment under the law, then they simply cannot condone this type of conduct. A great many thoughts have passed through my mind during the past 6 or 7 months, and I've wondered so many times to myself, and last night in preparing what I might say to you, I was reading through the Federalist Papers, and I thought, how in the world did we ever get from the Federalist Papers to the edited transcripts?
I recognize the gentleman from Mississippi, Mr. Lott, for general debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
For a period not to exceed 15 minutes.
Thank you. This has truly been an awesome, time-consuming, and exhausting task, and I really wonder if any of us here really can appreciate what this moment in history could mean to the future of our country. And while at various points along the way, I've really been somewhat disgusted with this committee proceedings, such as when we spent an hour earlier this week trying to decide not whether or not to have television cameras, but whether or not to have lights for the television cameras, I must admit, in all candidness, that it has been very fair, and I must take this opportunity to thank the chairman for his consideration of this particular member. And also, Mr. Chairman, I was particularly impressed with several of the comments that you made in your opening statement last night, and I would like to refer to those. Make no mistake about it. This is a turning point, whatever we decide. Our judgment is not concerned with an individual, but with a system of constitutional government. I believe that. Further quoting, for almost 200 years, every generation of Americans has taken care to preserve our system and the integrity of our institutions against the particular pressures and emergencies to which every time is subject. I subscribe to that. Quoting further, the founding fathers clearly did not mean that a president might be impeached for mistakes, even serious mistakes. These quotes I'd like to direct some of my attention to. But first, let me go back and put our present situation into the proper perspective. We are now in the final stages of review of some 15 months of the most intensive investigation of any president of the United States. Perhaps of any man. The Senate Select Committee, or Watergate Committee, spent some 18 months and over $2 million in its investigation. The grand juries in Washington, D.C. have spent over $225,000 in their proceedings since June of 1972. The special prosecutors have been at their task since May 1973 at a cost of over $2.8 million. And the House Judiciary Committee staff of some 100 have been working since January at a cost of over $1.17 million. There are reams of papers, thousands of pages, volumes of material, grand jury evidence, other congressional committee investigation papers, transcripts, tapes, logs, handwritten memos, and on and on and on. The sheer weight in pounds is overwhelming. Could any man withstand such scrutiny? Could any man go through all of this without some evidence of a questionable statement under pressure or while frustrated, or even without revealing some mistakes? I submit no. And where was a similar counterbalancing presentation of the other side of the story? Was the whole picture revealed properly? Was it in the Senate Watergate Committee? No. Was it in the grand jury or even in this committee? In this committee, the staff was nonpartisan, and I must give credit where credit is due for a fair presentation, until, of course, very recently, and that's understandable. But except for a last-minute shift in the minority counsel, the arguments against impeachment, the cons, the other side of the story, would not have been presented. Yes, the president's counsel, James St. Clair, was properly allowed to sit in this presentation of evidence and eventually to participate on a limited basis. His was the only argument on behalf of the president until the last presentation by Mr. Garrison. However, he was the president's counsel, not the committee's counsel, not my counsel. There was not a staff structure for a balanced presentation, in my opinion, and perhaps I share the blame for that. An interesting aside is the fact, and I get into the procedures, that last night at 7:30, we received the proposed articles of impeachment the night the debate began. Quite often, we've been faced with being hit at the last minute with what we were fixing to vote on. But regardless of that, we're now preparing to vote on articles of impeachment. I tried to maintain a restrained position because I think it's been incumbent upon every member to listen and keep his mouth shut until he had enough to make his decision. But I must also be frank in saying that I've approached this task from the standpoint that the president was innocent. Like any man under such proceedings should be presumed innocent until there was clear and convincing evidence to the contrary. You cannot impeach a president because you don't like his philosophy or on the basis of innuendo or contradicted evidence. In my opinion, you cannot impeach a president for half a case or on the basis of parts of several cases put together. And we're not faced with impeaching John Dean or John Mitchell or Magruder or any of these others. We are faced with impeaching the president. The line must be drawn directly to the president, clearly to the president. This has not been done. The president had several aides that served him and his country poorly. The legal processes are now dealing with them. But for every bit of evidence implicating the president, there is evidence to the contrary. What is at stake here is the presidency, and this is what has worried me all along. In my part of the country, we do worry about these institutions. We do still hold the institutions that made this country great, dear, and important. We have to consider the best interest of this country now and in the long run. We cannot allow political considerations or circumstantial evidence to be the basis for impeaching the first president of the United States in over 100 years, and I might add, in so many ways, the best president in that period of time. I think this is a classic example here of how perhaps all of us in this committee have gotten so deep in the forest that we've lost sight of the forest. We're now analyzing every diseased tree. And I think we've got to look beyond that. Let's take a look at a couple of specifics. There's not one iota of evidence that the president had any prior knowledge whatsoever of the Watergate break-in. And I don't want to get into quoting half of passages. I guess we could do that on and on. Each one quote one and then somebody that something to the contrary. And that's my point. So much contradicting evidence. The president himself, in the transcript of March 13, referred to the Watergate break-in like this. What a stupid thing. Pointless. That was the stupid thing. The president did not participate in a Watergate cover-up. True. He did not immediately throw all possibly involved immediately to the wolves. Would you, without knowing all the facts, have dismissed your principal aide? But upon learning from Dean on March 21st the real seriousness of what was happening, he started taking a series of actions to find out really what the truth, the whole story. The president on March 22nd said that Hunt could not demand blackmail money. They just wouldn't go along with that. He instructed Dean to prepare a report for him of what had really gone on. He never got that report. The attorney general was advised to report directly to the president. Members of the White House were instructed to go to the grand jury and to tell the truth. I think it is important that you've got to look at what eventually happened. I think that you must consider the fact that the president waived executive privilege for his closest aides, including his counsel. That's what really happened. And we could go on and on and on. With regard to Ellsberg psychiatrist break-in, Charles Colson testified before this committee that he was convinced that the president did not know in advance of the break-in. I'll make no comment on the part of the article that deals with contempt of Congress charge, because I think it's so ludicrous that it deserves no comment. Now, what is really the genesis of all this? What was the beginning of the whole thing? Now, I'm not saying that other things weren't important. And I had my difficult moments, particularly the conversation of March 21, which I've satisfied myself that the president did not order that payment. But the beginning, really, was with the bombing of Cambodia and impoundment of funds. And look at that. The bombing of Cambodia led to the eventual end of the longest war in his country's history. It was one of the important ingredients. An impoundment. Presidents have been impounding funds since Thomas Jefferson. And Kennedy and Johnson both percentage-wise impounded more than President Nixon. I think it's interesting that in a recent article in the Washington Post, August 2, 1971, it came out that under the Kennedy administration, through Assistant Attorney General Burt Marshall, there was a plan called Stick It to Mississippi, my home state. Stick It to Mississippi, remember that. And what was involved was the empowerment of funds on some 36 projects to force Mississippi to comply with certain Justice Department decrees and court decrees. It's empowerment. It's empowerment any way you look at it. But when it's empowerment of some other area, then it's a different horse. Now, many of those here have talked about the youth of America. And although I've grown much older in the last few months, I guess I'm still the youngest member of this committee. And I've been concerned at what impact Watergate would have on the young people of America. But I think maybe in the final analysis, they see all this more clearly than we do. And I really think the young people that I've talked to, and I've talked to a lot of them, have dedicated themselves to making this system better by working within the system. And no matter what we finally do in Congress, the presidency will be treated more carefully by future presidents. So I think we must take care to see that we don't do irreparable damage to the longest single existing form of government in the history of man. My question, and the final analysis, will be this. As strongly as I disapproved of the policies of Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, would I have voted to impeach them based on the evidence before this committee? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.